Session number 4814, reel 2.
Mr. Wyatt, reel 2.
I looked out from the hospital window, and I looked down and I said, "Oh, I've said that, haven't I?" Anyway, the Japanese was fired on evidently by some Indian troops who'd withdrawn, and they'd withdrawn into the hospital. And the next moment, there was such a hullabaloo downstairs, the Japanese burst in. Well, in the meantime, we knew that, had an idea that they, what they did to women, and we had a Eurasian orderly, female orderly in our ward, married to one of the Eurasian hospital students. Some of the hospital staff tried to dress her up as a man, or they did, they dressed her up as a man, and they took her downstairs to get her away, but the Japanese evidently found her. And the next moment, when I saw the Japanese in the hospital grounds, I immediately had the Japanese officer's watch, which I'd carried with me all the way down from Kampa, and I went to the toilets and I put it on top of the toilet so I didn't want it found on me. And just as I hobbled back into bed, because I had this ulcer on my foot as well, the swing doors of the hospital flew open, and it was more terrifying, really. One was about 6 foot, and the other was about 4'10". And they were covered in camouflage, and one had a live duck in his hand, and it was trying to get away, and the other, with his, he had a rifle in his hand, and he just levelled it at the patients. And I thought, well, this is the lot. But an orderly came along, and he walked down the wall, and he had some bread and some tea. And he went up to this tall Japanese, and he offered him the bread. And it was the first time I had really come up close as that, like in daytime at least, to the Japanese. And with one sweep of his hand, he made a guttural sound like, oh, and he knocked it off the plate, off from the tray of food, onto the floor. And then he proceeded to come up the ward, take all the watches and things that he could see, even the sick and, well, you know, everything like that. And downstairs, and at the same time, they evidently burst in, and if they found a tin of, say, bluebell, where they couldn't really see the Japanese troops.
What's bluebell?
Well, it's a polish, a bluebell polish, or even say a tin of blacking. You see, I'll just quote those things. They knock it with their bonnet and try to drink it because they didn't know what it contained. They just come out from the fighting line themselves, and they threw that away. But of course, then they burst up. They went into the operating theatre, and they took the nurses away, the Queen Anne's Honour nurses. They took them away and took all the orderlies away they could, and they shot a lot of them. And they attacked the doctors on the operating theatre. Well, of course, the time they got upstairs, they'd calmed down a bit when they came into the hospital, the top hospital where I was. And they hadn't been there, I suppose, taking the watches from upstairs where we were. Then the Japanese officers came up, and they kicked their backsides, put their backsides, and told them to get down below, kind of behave themselves in Japanese. And then he apologised in English for the behaviour, and he said, well, they'd just come in from the fighting line and they're thirsty and hungry, and that so they didn't know what they were doing, but he'd punish them for it. But they never were, because they went downstairs again and things were calm then. But
how did you know that they'd killed some of the orderlies and nurses?
Because you could hear the shots downstairs when they burst in. And when some of the chaps came up into our ward, they said that they'd gone berserk downstairs because someone would run upstairs to get away, and they come into our wall because we were on top. And they said they'd broken in downstairs and attacked the surgeons in the operating theatre and shot some people down there they came in.
Were any of the patients harmed?
The patients downstairs? Oh yeah. They burst into the operating theatre as they were operating. You see, they burst into the operating theatre as well, and the bayonets come out and things like that. I just went berserk downstairs.
Did they use the bayonets on the patients?
Well, as far as I know, they used it on some. I didn't see them myself, but that the fellows who rushed upstairs did. But I think you can read a book on that by a Sister Bullwinkle, an Australian nurse in the Queen Alexandra Nurses. She was taken away with the nurses, and she was taken to the beach, and they shot them. But her being tall only wounded her, and she'll verify that in her book. But I was in the hospital at the time, so I mean I know all about what happened upstairs.
Could you tell me what happened to you next, personally?
Yes. Then the surrender came while I was in hospital on the 15th of February. And all the patients were all taken as far as we could hobble or get up to a place called Changi in Singapore, where we were all rounded up and counted and put in different sections. And shall I go on?
Yes.
And from while we were there one night, and things got a bit bad as far as our food was concerned. We'd been cut down on our food, and we were getting very hungry. And so some chaps found out how to break out in the evenings to get condensed milk or bully beef, because the Japanese had put up a wire all round Changi, and they were policing it with Sikhs and their own Japanese troops. There was about six of us in the huts, and as a private shore of these Saris with me. Well, he wasn't my friend, but he was with me like I knew him. So he said to me, would I go out over the wire to get some extra food to contact the Chinese or the Indians? So I said, no, I was never very adventurous anyway. I said, no, I said, I'm going to stay here. So I said, well, I'm going. So he went with another chap. And about 20 minutes afterwards, I heard a shot. And the other chap, don't know his name now, but he came back. And he said that they'd got under and that they were caught and fell ashore, had been shot. He got away, this chap. He got away, but Shaw had been shot. And it wasn't until this last few months ago that his wife, who was pregnant, had got in touch with the association that I belonged to and asked if anybody knew what happened to him, as he was listed killed in action. Then I was able to verify that he'd been killed getting out through the wire, but he hadn't been shot by the in action. He'd been killed trying to get a tin of milk.
Can you describe what conditions were like for you in Changi?
The conditions weren't all that bad. At least we had somewhere to sleep. But the food, we used to get about 12 ounces of rice a day. And of course with that continuous rice diet and maybe a tablespoonful of sugar sprinkled over it three times a day with watery tea, we began to get beriberi. Myself, I began to feel sluggish, and it was though and I looked and my legs were swelling and my face was beginning to swell, and then I wondered why I couldn't walk quickly or run. It was though you was like in a dream trying to run and you couldn't move, and that was the beginning of the start of beriberi, apart from malaria, which we had no tablets for.
What could you do about beriberi?
If you could get eggs, if you could contact the Siamese, our doctor said, well, if you can contact the Chinese or anybody and try and get some eggs or peanuts, and if you could get those for 2 or 3 days, continuously eat them, which is rare, you could see the beriberi disappearing. But of course, if you couldn't, and it either reached your heart or even some chaps went on their brain, the water, that was only one of the very few things that you had to fight against, apart from dysentery, malaria, and as you went out back into the jungle, cholera and things like that.
Did you succeed in getting eggs and peanuts yourself?
I did get a few eggs, but now and again, because you couldn't get into contact, you weren't allowed to contact, you see, Chinese or the Indian tradesman. You couldn't. It was a death penalty, as you said before. Chap got out under the wire and was killed. So you had to try and smuggle some eggs through, which was very difficult. In some cases, we had some people who had been chemists in Sivi. They tried to get what they call lemongrass, and from the it had a lemon flavour.
Growing wild, was it?
Yeah, that's the ground. The lemongrass is growing wild, and they said, "Well, try and put that on your rice. It might give you a bit of vitamin in your rice, and also make your rice taste like lemon."
And did it?
Well, it didn't make any difference now, but it gave the rice a different flavour, a lemon flavour.
And what type of accommodation did you have?
We had huts, and there were about six men to a hut, which was quite reasonable. It wasn't too bad at all. But one night, about 6 o'clock, I suppose, I was feeling lonely, and I sat on this hill, and I could see the sea. And it was one of the times that I felt very lonely. We didn't know what was in store for us, and having no news from home at all, we didn't know what was happening in Europe, our families. And I sat on this kind of a hill while I was looking at the sea in Changi, and I saw the Japanese fleet were part of it, and it seemed endless. It was battleships, cruisers, destroyers. I thought, I'll never get home out of this. And that was one time I felt very despondent. This was about 1940-41, early 41, when we were in Changi. To see the ships all form up in convoy, and the Japanese propaganda all the way around saying that we'd never see our people again. War lasts 100 years. Japan win. You know.
What was the you said what your morale was like when you saw that huge fleet, but what was the morale of the chaps in Changi like in general? Was there a lot of despondency, or were people trying to be cheerful?
Well, you had a mixture. You had some people who were cheerful. It's like you're like in the streets now, maybe. You had some people who didn't want to go on and were despondent all the time. And I, myself, I felt despondent, especially when I saw the Japanese. You had to have a good friend, which I found a good friend eventually. But I had nobody at the time, nobody close. And I used to get very low. And
was there any tendency for the men to blame anybody for what had happened?
Oh, yeah. We blamed the authorities because we had no aircraft. And that was the chief thing. That was the chief man. There was no aircraft for protection at all. You were at the mercy of the Japanese. And we weren't in the same field, like, physically, or even as military as what they were. And we hadn't.
When you say blame the authorities, do you mean blame the British government?
We'd blame the British government because we knew that Morris had been sacrificed. That we were told that the Japanese were an inferior race. We had that opinion.
How did the Japanese behave towards you in Changi?
They were never a very good race of people to deal with, because if you didn't bow to them, they'd come across and they'd either slap your face or just put their foot behind you and push you over the back of their foot. And the officers could see that was going on, but they'd never come up like our officers would to a fellow and say, well, you can't do that to a German POW or Italian POW. They used to turn a blind eye to it and walk away. And although I've seen in the future, on the Japanese engineers on the railway, I've seen a Japanese soldier. He'd either gone absent without leave for a day or two, and he'd reported back to the officer in charge, and he'd, in front of us, they lined the Japanese soldier engineers up, and he'd shout out, say, Hirohito, and he'd say, hit, and he'd step forward and he'd read out the charge for him that he'd been absent somewhere, he hadn't done this or hadn't done that. And his fist would come up and he'd hit him in the chin. And he'd stagger a couple of paces, shake his head, and stand back into line again. But that was, I think, their punishment of losing face in front of us, the IWs. That was one of the things that I've seen them do.
And to be beaten in front of you.
That's right, yeah. And I could tell you different things in Japan where I've seen this, what I've seen them do to the civilians.
We'll come on to Japan later, but can you tell me how much organisation there was in Changi? Was there any organisation at all?
Yes, there was quite a... Yeah, we were organised into different regiments as far as we could, our own regiments, that was East Surrey's. And we had, which was a good thing, some discipline. We had to slaughter our own officers and keep ourselves smart and tidy as best we could, because sometimes it got to the point that we were only wearing a G-string. A bit of cloth, but all the time the British officers was trying to maintain discipline, which paid off in the end. At least we had some kind of something to look up to, salute the officers.
You said earlier that some of the Sikhs had gone over to the Japanese. Did you see any of them as guards at Changi?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, I've only seen them on guard duty, round the fence and outside the different gates. I haven't. That's all I did see of them.
And how did they behave towards the POWs?
They were aloof. They were aloof to us. Like, now they did get some Sikhs. Well, I know because two of our chaps tried to escape. The padre came back. There was two Australians and two of our fellas. And they'd taken them. They'd caught them. They caught four of them, all told. At the same time, they'd asked us not to sign a pledge not to escape, which we were advised not to do. And when they wouldn't sign it, they came to this hospital in Changi Hospital, and one of them had malaria, and they dragged the four of them out from their beds, and this chap was shivering with malaria because the padre came back and he said to us, try not to escape, he said, because it's not worth it. I said, I've seen something that's really, you know, shaken me up. He said the four men that were caught, they've gone to the hospital, as we haven't signed the no surrender forms, not no escape forms. They've taken men out from the hospital, and they've taken them to dig their own graves. And an Australian corporal said he was his fault. Could they shoot him instead? And he said no. And they got the Sikhs to shoot them, but they didn't make a very good job of it. And they fell back, shot by the Japanese, fell back in their own graves. And then the padre came back, and he said, I advise anybody not to try to escape.
What do you mean they didn't make a very good job of it?
They didn't shoot them properly. The Japanese had to finish them off. Did their own people, but the Sikhs tried to shoot them under orders from the Japanese.
Did those Sikh guards seem ashamed at all for having gone
over? No, they didn't seem ashamed, no. No.
How did the POWs behave towards the Sikhs?
Ignored them. Hated them. Hated anybody who went over. Even some of the Indians went over, but not very, very many, not very few of the Indians, and the Gurkhas not at all.
How long were you in Changi?
I was in Changi from about February to about May. And from there, I went on the advance party to build the railway.
Can you tell me how you were moved from Changi?
Yeah, we were moved to Singapore Station. And we were packed in cattle trucks. They were iron, and we couldn't believe it. It was about 27 feet long by about 12 foot wide, and they put 35 of us into each cattle truck. And we were all sitting in the cattle truck with our knees up, and the ones at the far end couldn't get any air at all because it got very hot. And if you wanted to go to the toilet, you had to, which was dysentery was rife as well, starting to get bad, and you had to just have to run to the opening of the door and you know, and go out like to the toilet best you could, and then you try and then push your way back into the front from somebody else to get some, to get nearer the doors, you see, because it was so hot. And it was just one mad, you know, scramble all the time, pushing and shouting and shouting until things settled down. And then we went right through to Malaya, right through Malaya for about 7 days. One Japanese corporal was in charge of the whole train. And at night time it got bitter cold going through. And in the daytime it was so hot that you were gasping for water. And when the train stopped at a station in Malaya, you'd all run, jump off the train under the supervision of the Japanese corporal. You'd run to the train, as the train let out the kind of hot water from the engine, like, you know, you'd rush with your cups and your mess tins to get some water to take back with the drink. And a lot of chaps, or they just died on those trains. Not a lot, but one here, one there, all the way down. But only, and of course, there was dysentery cases on there, beriberi malaria. But it was just, everybody just didn't take any notice. It was a regular day occurrence. It was more or less, well, so far it hasn't affected me, though.
Where did the train stop? Can you remember?
Well, they stopped at a place called Ipoh, I think, one of the main line stations in Malaya. You see, they went through Malaya, and until we got, you know, we stopped at a place in Thailand, and there was a station in Thailand. What I can't remember. I know we got off the train there. We were the advance party. We were told we were going to build a railway, and we got into a place called Ban Pong, and that was the advance base. And when we got there, it was just unbelievable because the Attap huts were built on stilts, and it was rainy time, because sometimes it used to rain 17 hours out of the 24. And we were taken in this Ban Pong, and we squelched through up to our ankles in mud and slime, and got onto these but there were platforms, like about 3 foot off the ground, stretched for about 600 yards, and we each went onto these allocated a bed space, one by the side of each other all the time, all the way down, with our mess tins and our bits of kit we had, and we were continuously cold at night time because we had no proper clothing, and in the daytime it was hot, and you could look up and you could see the rats. Of the night time, you could see the rats on top of the bamboo poles as you looked up. And we were continuously, we get, say, rice diet all the time, maybe a bit of meat thrown in or sweet potatoes. But there wasn't enough vitamins there, we were continuously hungry. And tea, we had never had any sugar or tea, it was just an ordinary big leaf Japanese tea, which we used to drink. And then we organised ourselves, and they got British officers organised the cooking. And they used to have a big quolly, big round thing, like a
big what?
What we used to call a quolly. We used to call them quollies. It was like an inverted umbrella. And we used to put the rice in them, and dig a hole in the earth, and make a fire under the earth, so it'd heat the quolly, and we'd have that. No, three times a day, the rice. Of course, beriberi again comes up, and we're all swelling up through lack of vitamin B1. And then we were told that we'd get extra rations when we started to work on the railway. So we were the advance party, and we had to go through the jungle, and it got to the point that we had no boots or socks. And we went through the jungle. It's unbelievable what we did. We went through the jungle without any boots or socks. No headgear. just a G string round your middle. And they issued us with a pick and a shovel and saws, on these big saws they used to fell the trees with out of the way. And when all the trees were, there's elephants there as well, and the elephants used to come through, and they used to, with the ball on top of the elephant, he used to hit the elephant on top with a kind of a hook. He used to hit the elephant there like that. On his forehead. And the elephant used to go down on its knees, and with its trunk, it used to roll the trees out the way. And that was cleared then. And there'd be then hundreds of gangs of four. It was like the old Egyptian slaves in the years gone by. And we'd be issued with a pick and a shovel and a rice sack and two bamboo poles. And we put, under the direction of the Japanese engineers, we used to put the two bamboo poles through the end of the rice sack and made it into a stretcher. We used to put them through the neck of the rice sack. And then we used to make a hole at the bottom of the rice sack and shove the two bamboo poles through. Therefore, we had a stretcher. And with a pick and a shovel, we had to dig about, the four of us, they used to give us what they call a task. And we had to dig about 12 foot from about, we used to get our early morning breakfast in the dark. And then we'd have these picks and shovels, and we'd have to dig about 12 feet, about 3 foot all the way around, and about 4 foot down. That was a task they used to set us. And with that, two men would pick and shovel the earth into the stretcher that was lying on the ground. Then when it was full up, two men would pick it up and run about 50 yards and dump it. And then they'd come back again, and hundreds of POWs doing that all day long. The embankment used to form with the contingency, and the Japanese engineers were on top of the banking all the time with a bamboo stick. And if you didn't do it quick enough or move quick enough, then you got it across your back. Well, then we used to have a piece of wood made like a square tennis bat with a handle on it, and one man on top of the embankment used to pat the sides of the earth of the embankment in as we used to dump it over. And then we'd put bits of grass in the side of the embankment to strengthen the sides, and the embankment would grow. You could see it growing all every day. And then another gang would come through lying the rails on top of the embankment with the
sleepers.
And all day long, you'd be going backwards and forwards, and you stop for half an hour for your what they call tiffin, your rice. And then a man would collapse with dysentery or thirst or hunger. And you'd say to the Japanese officer or the man in charge, the doctor would, our doctor, say that man's very ill, he can't go on. And with that, the doctor would either get a punch in the face or be tripped up on his back. And even by a Japanese corporal would do that to a British doctor. And you used to feel sorry for the doctor, because he was only saying the men couldn't work because they were too weak. But you had to have one leg, before they'd say that you were sick. But even with the chaps with one legs, when it got bad, they used to have to repair in baskets that we used to work with as well, or sacks on the side of the railway. And
did the sick get rations?
They got rations up. Yeah, they got rations up to a point. But sometimes they'd rather have, the sick would rather have a cigarette than their rations. And I myself was guilty, I suppose. I never smoked, so what cigarettes I could get hold of, which was very, very scarce, I'd trade. Well, not only me, but hundreds of chaps would trade for a sick man's rations, and we'd give him cigarettes. And the doctors would take a very dim view of it. They'd say, well, we can't do much about it now, but that man can do with that, with those rations. But what we say, well, if he can't eat the rations, he's dying. He might as well have a smoke. These rations will keep somebody else alive. And we used to do that, but a man would die just as he was on the point of shoveling up the earth, and he'd be taken back to camp. with either dysentery or, you know, died of dysentery or beriberi, malaria. It was diseases that used to come in all directions. There's so many diseases you had to fight against, apart from the low rations.